Usually when we talk about business success, whether it's like a tech startup hitting some massive valuation or even just a local restaurant with lines around the block, there's this underlying expectation of magic, I guess. Like we treat it like a lottery ticket. You get lucky, the universe smiles on you, your passion is pure, and bam, customers just appear out of nowhere.
Oh, it is heavily romanticized. I mean, our cultural narrative just loves the idea of destiny,
Right.
or that, possessing one perfect golden idea is all it actually takes to build an empire.
But then you actually look under the hood of a business that survives its first few years, and well, that romantic view completely vanishes. We're looking at a landscape that is highly mechanical. It's an engine.
Exactly, an
And if you don't
engine.
understand how to read the manual for that engine, you're eventually going to blow the transmission. And that is what we are decoding today in this deep dive, the literal operating system of commerce.
It's a fascinating framework.
It really is. We've got our hands on this incredibly detailed manual titled Commerce, a comprehensive operating guide. So whether you are prepping to launch a side hustle or trying to analyze your employer's broader strategy, or you're just insanely curious about why your favorite local coffee shop randomly closed down last week.
Right, despite having great lattes, right?
Yeah, despite the great lattes, this deep dive is going to break down the actual science of business survival and success.
And, the guide grounds this entire concept right away with a really necessary reality check.
Okay, lay it on us.
The ultimate test of this commercial engine is not social media praise. It's not vanity metrics like top-of-funnel website traffic. And it certainly isn't compliments from your friends and family. The true, uncompromising test is whether real customers repeatedly pay enough money at a controllable cost to produce durable cash flow.
Durable cash flow.
Right, because if that specific mechanism isn't happening, you don't actually have a business. You basically just have a very expensive, highly stressful hobby.
A stressful hobby. Yeah, I've had a few of those. So
Yeah.
to build that specific mechanism, we obviously have to understand what fuels it, right?
Exactly.
And I think the most common assumption is that a great product is the fuel. But the source material argues that assuming a quote-unquote good product automatically equals a good business is, well, it's a deeply dangerous illusion.
It really is. The text defines commerce fundamentally as the organized exchange of value under uncertainty.
Under uncertainty, yeah.
It is not just, moving merchandise from point A to point B. And within that definition, there's just a massive delta between a product that seems good and a product that actually
Well, you
sells.
break that down for me. What's the difference?
Well, a product that seems good might impress the founders, right? It might win industry design awards or get lauded by technical experts. But a product that actually sells is one that solves a really painful, urgent problem for a specific customer, a customer who is actively willing to pay to remove that pain.
Right. And the guide uses this anecdote about a local cafe that I think just perfectly illustrates this disconnect.
Oh, the cafe example is so good.
Yeah, so imagine a new cafe opens up. They buy the absolute most premium, ethically sourced beans from around the world. They import a, $50,000 custom espresso machine from Italy.
The dream setup.
Right. The technical product, the coffee itself, is objectively fantastic, but the location has literally zero parking. The meticulous pour-over service takes 10 minutes per cup, and the prices are significantly above what the local demographic usually pays.
So the technical product is flawless, yet the commercial system fails completely.
Completely.
Why? Because for a morning commuter, the variables of convenience, speed, and just frictionless access, they completely dominate the quality of the bean.
Yeah, I just want my caffeine.
Exactly. The commuter is hiring that cup of coffee to wake them up and get them to the office on time. They are not hiring it to have some transcendent culinary revelation.
It reminds me of the trap people fall into with modern dating apps, honestly.
How so?
Like, you can't just write a profile listing all your objectively impressive qualities, right? I have a great job, I run marathons, I own a premium Italian espresso
Yeah,
machine.
right.
You actually have to fulfill a need or complement the context of the other person's life. And to figure out that context in business, the guide outlines four pretty brutal customer questions you have to answer.
Yeah, the four questions. Who are they? What is their current workaround for the problem? What will they actually pay? And why do they hesitate?
The hesitation one is big.
It is. But the focus on the current workaround is where the text radically redefines customer discovery. It argues strongly against just gathering static demographic data.
Like just knowing their age and zip code.
Exactly. Knowing your customer is a 35-year-old woman in the suburbs tells you almost nothing about her actual purchasing triggers. The guide insists on behavioral evidence.
So like watching what they do instead of what they say.
Precisely. Paid pilots, pre-orders, closely observing what people already spend money on to solve the problem, that matters infinitely more than hypothetical survey praise.
Because surveys lie.
Well, human nature lies, yeah. If you ask people in a survey, hey, would you buy this premium coffee? Human nature dictates they will politely say yes.
Right. They don't want to hurt your feelings.
But if you ask them to actually hand over their credit card, the polite fiction drops. You find out the economic truth.
Okay, let me push back on that strict methodology for a second, though.
Sure.
Didn't Steve Jobs famously say that customers don't know what they want until you show it to them? Doesn't this strict demand must precede supply law kind of kill true innovation? I mean, are we just supposed to build boring, iterative things that people explicitly ask for?
That's a great point. And the source actually addresses the boundaries of innovation directly. It doesn't preclude invention at all.
Right.
However, it clarifies that even highly innovative, completely novel products must ultimately solve a recognized problem within a buyer's willingness to pay. And they must reduce friction.
So it still comes back to the problem.
Always. You might invent a brand new spatial computing headset that people didn't explicitly ask for, right? But if it doesn't eventually connect to a real, urgent, human need like communicating faster or feeling connected to loved ones or saving travel time, then it remains an invention.
It doesn't become commerce.
Exactly. The demand for the underlying outcome must exist, even if the specific technological vehicle is brand new.
Wow. Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So validating that outcome is just the spark, though. You still have to build the engine block to capture it.
Right. The mechanics.
Yeah. And the guide breaks down this commerce engine into 10 linked elements. Let me read these off. Customer, demand, offer, price, access, trust, transaction, repeat, turnover, profit, and finally, cash flow.
And the architectural concept to really grasp here is that these are linked sequentially as a multiplier equation. They aren't just a list of independent departments.
A multiplier equation. So if one breaks,
a weakness at any single stage acts as a bottleneck that chokes the output of the entire system.
What?
So if your transaction stage, let's say your online checkout process, is broken and drops a huge percentage of users, it mathematically doesn't matter how incredible your offer is or how much pent-up demand you generated. Anything multiplied by zero is zero.
That is brutal. Mm-hmm. And looking at law five in the system, it focuses on the access element. Mm-hmm. And this really caught my eye. The law states, a location must buy demand.
Yes.
It draws this really sharp contrast between a good location in an expensive location, which sounds backwards, right?
It does, but it's brilliant. Yeah. A good location might actually have a very high monthly rent, but it's affordable relative to the highly qualified, ready-to-buy traffic it naturally brings to your door.
Right.
Whereas an expensive location is one that might have cheap rent, but it possesses low natural demand. It might be hidden down a side street, lack parking, or just be a nightmare for delivery drivers to navigate.
The guide mentions the occupancy cost ratio here.
Right. So rent isn't merely a fee you pay a landlord for physical space to store your inventory. It is fundamentally a customer acquisition cost.
Wow. Rent is customer acquisition cost.
Exactly. The ratio looks at your rent as a percentage of your gross sales. If you choose a cheap, hidden location in an industrial park because you think you are saving on fixed overhead, you aren't actually saving money.
You're just shifting the cost.
Yes. You are forcefully shifting that exact cost into permanent ongoing advertising subsidies. You now have to spend thousands on billboards or digital ads just to get people to find your hidden door.
It's like opening a Michelin star restaurant inside a bank vault.
That's a great way to put it.
I mean, the food is incredible. The rent for the vault is probably zero. But nobody can get past the steel door.
Mm.
So you're forced to spend massive amounts of your budget on marketing just to give people the combination to the safe every single night.
Exactly.
But wait, for you listening who want to start an online shop or something, if you're building a purely digital business today, like a SaaS product,
what?
Remote consulting firm, does this concept of location even matter anymore? You don't have a physical door.
Oh, it absolutely applies, just through a different medium. The source clarifies that digital platforms, search engine optimization rankings, and local map listings, those are the modern location.
Okay, so the algorithm is the landlord.
Precisely. algorithm dependency or digital ad costs replace physical rent. If you build a beautifully coded website, but no one can find it on the first page of search results, you are essentially back in that bank vault.
Right.
You still have to pay Google or Meta to acquire the traffic, which is just digital rent by another name.
Man, digital rent. Okay, so let's say you unlock the vault, you secure the demand, you figure out the physical or digital location, and traffic is flowing.
Things are looking good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if the underlying unit economics are wrong, you're just doing a lot of exhausting work for free.
Yeah.
So let's look at the actual numbers. The guide goes incredibly deep into the pricing architecture here. Specifically, the danger of confusing gross profit with contribution margin.
This is a lethal trap for so many founders.
For an audience that already knows what gross profit is, why does the guide treat it as such a danger?
Because looking solely at gross profit creates a false sense of security. Gross profit typically just subtracts the direct cost of the good itself from the revenue.
Right, the materials.
But the contribution margin subtracts all variable costs tied to that specific transaction. Packaging, credit card processing fees, delivery commissions, return logistics.
Oh, wow. All the hidden stuff.
Exactly. Businesses fail quietly because they look at their healthy gross profit and assume they have plenty of room to cover their fixed overhead, completely ignoring how those variable costs scale up with every single sale.
Okay, the manual walks through a numerical example that makes this terrifyingly clear. Let's say you sell a physical item for $18.
Okay, $18.
And the variable costs, well, wait, the core materials cost you $7? Or no, sorry, let's use the guide's numbers. Your variable costs in total, including packaging and fees and ingredients, are $7.
Right, $7 total.
So your contribution margin is $11 per item, 18 minus 7.
And that $11 is what actually matters.
Right, because if your monthly fixed costs, like your lease, insurance, salaries, sit at $30,000, you divide that $30,000 by your $11 contribution margin to find your break-even point.
Which is
2,727 units. You have to sell 2,727 units every single month before you make a single dollar of actual profit.
And pricing is the primary lever that dictates that entire equation. The text emphasizes that pricing is an economic instrument and a signal.
A signal to the market.
Yes. It explicitly warns against cost plus pricing, which is just taking your internal costs and arbitrarily slapping, say, a 20% markup on top.
Right, because that ignores value.
Exactly. Cost plus pricing is dangerous because it completely ignores the perceived value from the customer's perspective.
So to change the math at that break-even point, the guide introduces the revenue formula. And I love this part. It's visitors multiplied by conversion rate, multiplied by average transaction value, multiplied by repeat frequency.
It's a beautiful formula.
Yeah, and the underlying mechanism is the compounding effect. The guide highlights that improving each of those four levers by just 10% doesn't yield 40% growth.
Right, because they multiply against each other.
Exactly. 1.1 to the power of 4 compounds to approximately 46% revenue growth. The 46% miracle.
That math proves you don't need to attempt the Herculean task of doubling your total customer base to radically transform the business. You just need systemic, incremental improvements across the existing chain.
Yeah, I look at that exactly like lifting weights.
Okay, how so?
Like, you don't walk into the gym on day one and try to double the weight on the bar, right? You'd completely break your back.
For sure.
Instead, you make micro adjustments. You improve your form by 10%. You dial in your sleep by 10%. Your diet by 10%. And those small levers compound into massive strength gains over time.
That's a perfect analogy.
But let me ask you this. If I'm looking at that formula and I just desperately need to boost my conversion rate by 10% this month, shouldn't I just slash my prices, like run a massive discount?
The guide strongly cautions against that. Permanent discounting trains your customers to wait. It actively degrades the psychological signal of your value.
So no sales.
Well, discounts should only buy a specific outcome, like an off-peak visit, maybe a Tuesday afternoon happy hour at a restaurant, or a first-time trial. If you discount purely to inflate your conversion metric, you're destroying that $11 contribution margin we just established.
Right, because now you have to sell, what, 5,000 units instead of 2,727 just to keep the lights on?
Exactly. You're working twice as hard for less money.
But here is the truly terrifying part of this manual. You can have perfect margins, nail the 46% growth, have a flawless location, and still go bankrupt next Tuesday because of Law 4, cash before accounting comfort.
Profit and cash flow are entirely different things. Profit is an accounting concept. Cash is the actual oxygen the engine breathes.
Yeah, the text shows how a business's accounting profit can steadily rise month over month on paper, while its actual cash balance plummets to zero.
Because the money gets physically trapped.
Trapped in the pipeline. Like, you make a massive B2B software sale, record $1 million in profit today, but the client negotiated net 90 terms. You aren't getting a check for 3 months.
Right. You can't pay your engineering team this Friday with a receivable.
Exactly. Profit is your speedometer, telling you how fast you're generating value. But cash flow is your gas tank. You can be going 100 miles an hour, but if the tank hits empty, the car stops dead.
To prevent that, the guide introduces the 13-week cash forecast as the ultimate radar system.
But isn't projecting out 13 weeks line by line just guessing?
It's not about perfect clairvoyance. A 13-week window is exactly one quarter. It's long enough to capture cyclical drains like tax payments or insurance, but short enough that your revenue assumptions are grounded in reality.
So you spot the empty gas tank weeks before you hit it.
Exactly. Most businesses don't fail from one dramatic event. They fail from a slow sequence of optimistic assumptions overriding weak controls.
And if you hit a crisis, there's a turnaround sequence. Step one, protect cash today, so freeze spending. Step two, establish economic truth. And step three, identify the profitable core.
And implementing step two often reveals a fascinating early warning indicator. Long before a company misses a debt payment, you'll see the founder working significantly more hours while results get worse.
Heroics replacing systems.
Exactly. The underlying machine is broken and the owner is using their own sheer willpower to paper over the cracks.
But if I'm in that death spiral, isn't it noble to just keep fighting and pour my personal savings in to save my team?
The source material is very harsh on this. It says to set a strict decision deadline and a hard numerical threshold for closure. Mm-hmm. Do not consume all personal capital in an indefinite rescue.
It's just delaying mathematical inevitability.
Exactly. Draining your family's savings isn't noble if the core margin is fundamentally broken.
Wow. Okay, let's look at the flip side. You survived the cash crunch. You have a functional business. The final boss is scaling it. And the guide defines a scalable business very strictly.
Yes. It can increase output or add units without requiring the founder's time and personal risk to increase at the same rate.
Right. And to do that, Law 10 says reputation compounds. Trust is hard economics.
Unethical shortcuts, like opaque pricing or poor data protection, they create hidden liabilities. They surface later as refunds, turnover, loss of financing. High trust reduces friction and lowers your customer acquisition cost.
So to achieve this scale, the owner has to transition from a worker to a system designer, like a head chef at a hot new restaurant. To open a second location, the chef has to physically put down the knife, stop cooking, and start writing the recipe book so others can replicate the magic.
That transition is the ultimate graduation from heroics to sustainable systems, documenting tasks, delegating outcomes, not chores.
Incredible. Well, we've covered a massive amount of ground today on this deep dive. Whether you're evaluating a startup to join or just try to be a smarter consumer, remember the core laws. Demand must precede supply. Systems beat heroics. And cash is reality.
It's an engine, and it can be understood.
Exactly. I want to leave you with a final profound question adapted from the very end of this guide. It asks business owners this, but I challenge you to apply it to your own life right now. What is the single constraint that most limits your personal operating system today? And what 10% micro experiment can you run this week to break it?